Good morning, everyone. I noticed from the numbers at the bottom of the screen, we have some visitors, and welcome to you. Thank you for coming, in a metaphorical sense. This is the second day of our June 2020 Sesshin. We're not meeting physically in this Sesshin, but the most important part of each of us is here, present in this moment. And that is our attention, our full and complete attention. So give that attention your all. Hold nothing back. This Sesshin is like none we have ever held. Normally, of course, we convene in our Zendo at the center, or Shambhala, or the Eco Dharma Center, away from home, withdrawn from the world. Now we are meeting, but still in our own homes and in the world. Like all such suddenly changed situations, there is a challenge and an opportunity. The challenge is to maintain a strong Sesshin practice in our home and in the marketplace. Is that even possible? The opportunity is to gain the strength and practice that meeting such a challenge can bring us, namely, to live and practice in the world, but not of the world. Zen is called the meditation sect or the mind sect of Buddhism. And we have to admit that historically, Zen has always appealed to the intellectual, the head tripper, to the elite. The Zen adepts of ancient China were for the most part priests, aristocracy or children of the aristocracy, the bureaucracy, or the academics, who entered a monastery at a very young age. Of course, there were and are exceptions. Wei Nung was an illiterate woodcutter. Fu Daishi was a farmer. In this mindset, it is easy to forget about or ignore the body. However, the Buddha said, it is in this very fathom-long physical frame, with its perceptions and mind, that I declare lies the world, and the arising of the world, and the cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world. This very body, the body of Buddha. It is in this very body, with this perception and mind that does Zazen, that practices, that breathes, hungers, and eats, gets tired, and rests. This body, with its heart and lungs and guts and genitals and brain, is all we have in this world of time, space, and karma. It is all we have to realize time, space, and karma. This Sesshin is an opportunity to explore the body in motion, at rest, and anywhere in between. We will all be preparing and eating our own meals, washing up, making our beds in the morning, doing household chores, maybe going to work during the day. You are spending a large part of the Sesshin in familiar surroundings, doing habitual things. And you can enter into this home activity in a way you may not have before. Your home is now your Zendo. In the numerical discourses, the Buddha said, they do not partake of the deathless who do not partake of mindfulness directed at the body. They partake of deathlessness who partake of mindfulness of the body. They have fallen away from the deathless who have fallen away from mindfulness of the body. They have not fallen away from the deathless who have not fallen away from mindfulness directed to the body. This is reiterated several times in the sutra with variations. One must not neglect, be heedless of, or forget mindfulness of the body. One must pursue, cultivate, directly know, fully understand, and realize mindfulness of the body. It's a strange paradox that Dogen's teacher, Jantong Rujing, said the study of Zen is the dropping off of body and mind. And yet, body and mind are absolutely essential to the dropping off of body and mind. Let's do an inventory. Where are you feeling tension in this moment? In the neck? Shoulders? How about the upper back? The lower back? Tops of the hips, the thighs, knees, ankles? Where are the pressure points? On your sit bones, your ankles? Are you leaning against something? Where are you feeling air currents? Around the face, the ears? Where is your breath? Breathing in, feeling it as it passes through the nose and the throat. Is it cold, warm, dry? Does it fill the chest cavity, the belly? Breathing out, is it warm or cold? In the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha teaches full awareness of the body at all times and places, active or quiescent in all daily activities, looking ahead, looking away, moving limbs, wearing clothing, eating, drinking, tasting, defecating, urinating, walking, sitting, standing, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. The list is endless. There are so many activities that are done every day, such as brushing teeth, combing hair, washing, bathing, preparing food, some aspect of cleaning, mopping or vacuuming, where one can focus entirely on the body, its posture, and its movements. There are specific body practices, of course. Yoga, Tai Chi, dance forms, martial arts, or many athletic endeavors. Even the formal study of anatomy can be helpful. But these kinds of exercises can also lead to pride, even an obsession with preserving or attaining some particular skill or bodily appearance. It is not about attaining some goal or pursuing a notion of perfection, of strength, or flexibility. Body practice, like all practices of Zazen, is observation, seeing clearly the body as it is, as it changes over time. An important part of realizing the body is to contemplate the less pleasant aspects of our anatomy. There are hairs, some on the head, some in less attractive parts of the body. And there are nails, teeth, skin, muscle tissue, tendons, ligaments, and the like. There are bones, marrow, all the internal organs, kidneys, heart, liver, lungs, spleen, and mesentery. There is the whole digestive tract, basically a long convoluted tube that starts at the mouth where delicious food may enter, but that which leaves at the other end, not so much. Does anybody like to contemplate that end product? And yet it is worth contemplating. You also have spit, sweat, blood, fat, snot, joint fluid, and urine. The Buddha said, just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu, that's a monk, reviews this same body. So the Buddha prescribes seeing the body in much the same manner as if you were actually conducting an autopsy or a dissection. A few years ago, an exhibit called Body World toured the country, and it was on display for some weeks at the Denver Museum of Science and Nature. It was a collection of detailed and very creative dissections of human beings and some animals. There were huge crowds in attendance, and as an old biology teacher, I found it fascinating. But I also found the cut-up bodies to be pretty ugly. Having done some human dissection, I've always thought that once you strip the skin, there's not a whole lot to admire aesthetically in the hidden reality beneath. Another part of this practice of observing the body is to observe one's own aging process. If you're into middle age, consider what you could do 20 years ago that you can no longer do. Consider your strength now, your endurance. Consider your hair, your skin, muscle tone, body fat. How hard do you have to work to maintain fitness as you get older? How many illnesses have you had? Do you recover as completely as you used to? How many surgeries have you needed to maintain life and function? Can we observe all that with equanimity? As being of a certain age, pushing 80, this is something I have been experiencing for some time. I look at the weakening, the joint pain, the sagging, and I suppose I could rail against it, dream of my days of youth as a competitive athlete, or I can contemplate it, see that it's okay, and not just okay, but it's good. The body itself is the great reality, if seen correctly. Our goal in practice, if we can speak of goals, is not transcendence. It's too much like an escape. Our goal is to realize the body, to make it real, to the point where it is in no way separate from the great reality itself. That is total immersion in the karmic body until it becomes the very body of Buddha. You have to give up the notion of control. You can't control the movements of the stars or the galaxies, nor can you control the movements of atoms and molecules. What makes you think you can control the body? In order to control something, you have to know exactly how it works, where all the control knobs are. Well, how familiar are you with the neuromuscular control system? Are you knowledgeable about actin and myosin or the synthesis of adenosine triphosphate? Do you know how the sarcoplasmic reticulum operates? What happens at the neuromuscular junction? Whether you know it or not is completely irrelevant. The body knows. You don't. Here's a personal experience that I've spoken of before. Many years ago, I was at a session in Santa Fe, New Mexico, conducted by Dane and Henry Roshi. Sometime during the fourth or fifth night, I sat up very late during yaza, that's late night sitting. I left the zendo and went into the kitchen and got a cup of tea and took it to the dining room and sat on the floor in a corner. I held the cup in my hands. As I stared at the table opposite me, I raised the cup to my lips for a drink. And I suddenly realized that I had had no conscious intention to do so. It just happened. So I began to pay attention to this strange phenomenon. I stared at the cup in my hand and tried to predict when I would again raise it to my lips. I couldn't. Time and again, I thought, I'll do it now. And it didn't happen. But a moment later, my hand and cup moved as if someone else was controlling it. Paying close attention, I realized that every time I moved, the conscious mind immediately jumped in and claimed credit, but only after the fact. That was the first time I realized that the conscious mind does not control anything. It only pretends to be in charge. Of course, we all experience the spontaneous postural adjustments, shifting of the body weight from foot to foot, scratching, rubbing, and so on. We accept these as natural. But then we indulge in the fantasy that the really important stuff we plan and execute consciously, like standing up and sitting down, or walking in some direction. I contend that none of that is true. The conscious mind is not a leader, only a very clever follower. But it is only in the deep stillness of Zazen that this becomes evident. In a remarkable book with the catchy title of The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, psychologist Julian James asserts that there was a pre-conscious civilization whose members had no conscious mind as we experience it today. His main example is ancient Troy, as depicted in the Iliad. I won't go into the details of his argument. What's important is his discussion of schizophrenia, which is relevant here. A patient recalls, instead of wishing to do things, they are done by something that seems mechanical and frightening. The feeling that should dwell within a person is outside, longing to come back and yet having taken with it the power to return. And James comments, behavior is either responding to hallucinated directions or continues by habit. The remnant of the self feels like a commanded automaton, as if someone else were moving the body about. A patient may have the feeling of being commanded in ways in which he must obey. He may shake hands normally with a visitor, but when asked about this, will reply, I don't do it. The hand proffers itself. Or a patient may feel that somebody else is moving his tongue in speech. We're not trying to become schizophrenics. But it's clear to me that in schizophrenia, the ego self has simply lost the ability to jump out in front and assume its false leadership role. But this is not enlightenment, far from it. The ego self has been torn loose with no preparation or grounding in Zazen practice and understanding. The panic reaction is a total distraction that allows the karmic self to run wild. It is only after a long, hard struggle that we are able to deliberately let go, seeing clearly this disconnect between intent and the reality of the movement. Did I know I was going to do that? The poet Wendell Berry writes, willing to die, you give up your will, keep still until moved by what moves all else, you move. We don't really let go of the body. The body has already dropped off. Actually, it never even dropped off because it was never on. We just managed to fool ourselves. All this flies completely in the face of our Western understanding of ourselves and our karma. And it would be easy to fall into a nihilistic funk. In this life, our choices are reduced to exactly one. We can pay attention, full and complete attention, or not. That's it. Attention to what? Attention to this moment and nothing else. If we completely realize this truth, then the scales fall from our eyes, and every action is Buddha action, the total liberation of our true nature, functioning freely, without effort. Every act, every moment becomes a wondrous gift and a miracle. Full attention erases separation. Full attention is to become intimate. Full attention changes everything in a trice. How? What is the mechanism by which attention in Zazen changes everything? I have no clue. That is the great mystery and the miracle of Zazen. Greed, hatred, and ignorance are the result of not paying attention. If you pay full attention, realize every action fully, it is impossible to commit evil. Full attention, however, is very difficult. The ego self creates distractions galore. All our evil and foolish acts happen when we are not paying attention. The only way you can put your all into paying attention is to give up everything else. Thus, the great impediment to full attention is knowing. You must realize that you have no clue as to what will happen in the next year, the next month, day, hour, the next breath. Full attention requires don't know mind. Spend this session paying full attention every moment. And finally, in the Gospel of Thomas, there is the following. Jesus said, "If they ask you, what is the evidence of your Father in you?" Now for us, that would be to say, what is the evidence of your Buddha nature? And Jesus said, "Tell them, it is motion and rest." Wow. Together with all beings, we realize the way.